I think the main potential causes of trauma is our culture's insistence on separation, whether that looks like separation at birth. I know there's quite a few places that still separate mums and babies when they're born, if you're in hospital, and it's common practice, whether it's separation, later on a few months down the line when parents are told to keep babies in separate rooms, whether it's separation when parents are told to send their babies 5 days a week to, a kind of nursery setting. And I wanted this to sound, as in this is a cultural thing, a systemic thing, rather than individual parents making choices, because I understand a lot of the times parents can make no other choice.
You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
Hello, welcome back to the Untaming podcast for this bonus episode. I am releasing it to coincide with the full worm moon here in the southern hemisphere, where we are in the throes of spring. Currently, we have 5 baby lambs jumping around our paddock. All of our chickens are laying an egg a day. The trees all around us are developing new buds. And my youngest child turned 1 last week. Our 3rd free birth baby has already had an entire trip around the sun. If you have listened to all of the episodes so far, you'll know that I chose to end the podcast after her birth because I didn't think I would have enough time to maintain the podcast as well as meet all of the evolved nest needs of our 3 children whilst homeschooling the older 2. And I'm so pleased that I made that decision because Maru and I recorded today's episode back in February, and it has taken 7 months for me to just find the time to edit and upload this single episode. But despite being very full, life is great. We are all loving our land that we have now experienced all 4 seasons on. I absolutely love homeschooling the older 2 children. We do very minimal formal education, about half an hour a day, 4 days a week. And the strong sibling bond between the 3 of them being together all the time is so encouraging. The older 2 do swimming lessons, gymnastics and capoeira, which is a Brazilian martial art. And we meet up with our homeschooling co-op once a week. And we really have found our community with them. The kids and I have all developed close friendships. The baby has been my easiest child by far. Made even easier having the older 2 as eager extra hands to hold her, but also because so many things have become so easy for me through experience, breastfeeding, acceptance that all of my children only ever take short cat naps during the day, the patience that has grown with the understanding that their behaviour is age appropriate, and matching their distress with gentleness and kindness helps them to regulate their emotions safely while maintaining our own relationship. And of course, elimination communication, which is what Maru and I talked about in this episode, along with aware parenting and recovering from trauma. Enjoy. Year-old Maru Rojas grew up in Mexico and now lives in London with her husband and their 2 children, who are 2 and 4 3/4. Maru is an elimination communication and potty training consultant and aware parenting instructor. Her website is parenttogether.co.uk. Last night, she had just under 8 hours of sleep, and for breakfast this morning, she had homemade granola, kefir, and coffee. Maru, welcome to the show.
Hi, Emily. Well, thank you.
So we've been in contact through Instagram for a few years now, and you even participated in the 10 questions in 10 minutes series I had going a couple of years ago. I wonder if, to start us off, you could tell us about aware parenting.
Sure. So aware parenting is I guess it's a type of attachment parenting philosophy, and it was founded, well, it's based around 6 books written by Aletha Salter, who is a PhD, developmental psychologist, I think she is.
Right, yeah.
Swiss-American. And so she wrote these 6 books and sort of coined the term aware parenting. And it's all based, it's based around three principles, actually. So should I go into that now? Is that a good
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That'd be good.
So the first principle is that aware parenting is a type of attachment parenting. And I kind of emphasize a type of, because there's lots of ways of doing attachment parenting, and it supports parents to do, you know, whatever they feel capable of doing. But obviously it also promotes, you know, breastfeeding and co-sleeping and all of these attachment practices and just being responsive with babies. Mm-hmm. And the second principle is that there's no punishment. It's non-punitive discipline, so no punishment and no rewards. And that goes together with the third principle, which is the understanding that children heal from stress and trauma through crying, raging, and laughter. And that just not just healing from stress and trauma, but also that all behavior has an underlying either accumulation of feelings or a lack of information or an unmet need. So that's kind of, those are kind of the three core principles of aware parenting.
Okay, right. Yeah, because one of my questions was going to be, how does it differ to attachment parenting? But to me, it's along the same lines, but almost, I want to say improved on it, but like there's more to it as well.
That's it. There's an extra depth. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Another layer, yes. So how did you get into it? Like, what benefit did you see in your own life from practicing it?
Well, I discovered it when my daughter was about 6 months old and we'd had 6 months of no sleep, basically. And I was desperate. And the first book on parenting that I read was The Containing Concept. And I remember thinking, I'm doing everything that the book says. And she doesn't talk about children not sleeping, right? She doesn't know what people do. Of course, there's a village and I don't have a village. So what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
And I mean, I always felt like resentful in a way that I was doing all the things and it wasn't giving me any sleep at all. And I also remember feeling that I didn't want to go down the sleep training route. I felt quite strongly about that.
Yeah.
But I was so desperate and the messaging that I was getting was very much around, well, if you don't do it, you're never going to get any sleep. And if you don't get any sleep, you're not a good parent, which I could see I wasn't being a good parent because I was just living in some kind of like survival pace. So yeah, I felt kind of trapped. I felt really like, well, either there's either sleep training in one form or another or nothing, and the nothing is killing me. And then luckily a friend mentioned this book, The Aware Baby, and I read it and it was like a revelation, and it opened this like, oh, this is why my baby isn't sleeping. And now I can understand that maybe offering the breast every single time that she cries, even when she's not hungry, is not helping her sleep in a way, because it's not helping her express feelings and maybe heal from a traumatic birth, because we had quite a long birth. And yeah, in a nutshell, that's how I came upon it, basically. And slowly I saw improvements and things starting to make sense. And I guess I just kind of really fell into the role of parenting in a way that felt good to me. Up to that point, I was very doubtful, I guess, of everything. You know, is this right? Why are the babies sleeping? Why does my daughter doesn't, you know, what does she like the pram? Why doesn't she like the cot? Why doesn't she like, you know, all of these. This makes sense. Okay, so it's fine, and I can help her sleep better, and I can listen to her feelings, and I can still breastfeed for however long I feel the need to breastfeed. So yeah, things sort of fell into place.
Great. So you were able to help improve both of your sleep without sleep training and still co-sleeping, just by being there and comforting her. Am I understanding this correctly?
Well, it was a mix of, actually, I didn't change much at night at the beginning. It was more not offering the breast during the day when she would cry and wasn't really hungry. Or when I noticed that she, you know, she had a need to cry. And up till that point, I was terrified of her crying. I thought that I wasn't meeting a need. And I just, you know, desperately tried to meet all her needs. But even, you know, at this point, we were practicing elimination communication. So I knew that she'd gone to the toilet. I knew she'd had a feed recently. I knew she was comfortable and warm. And I sort of met all her needs and I was close to her and she would start crying. And I would just feel panicked and felt like I didn't know what I was doing and why was she crying. And I often went down the route of like, well, she must be overtired. And so I need to like rock her and help her get to sleep. And I realized that actually what she needed was to be listened to in those moments. So it looks like holding a baby in arms and just letting them express those feelings through crying once you know that all the needs have been met.
Right. Yes, I'm with you now. Yeah. Okay, so now, because you've touched on elimination communication, so along these same lines of responding to children's needs, you've listened to the other episodes I've done on this topic, and I love that you suggested a few other points that I haven't touched on yet. So can you tell us, to start with, can you tell us what it means to practice elimination communication, say, part-time? How does this look?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think EC can look like many different things. And then, you know, originally it just looks like babies not wearing any nappies and they're mm-hmm. responded to whenever they need to go, they're held over something and they eliminate. But that's not always practical for the lives that we live now, especially like me. You live in London, which is a cold climate, and it's a big city, and often we're living in houses and flats and places without outdoor space. So EC part-time can look like either just doing it mm-hmm. once a day. So babies wear nappies, first I should say. And you can do full-time EC and still wear nappies. But part-time EC is when you just take babies to you offer the potty at certain times, but not always responding to every single cue. So you know that the baby needs to eliminate, but you're not always able to offer the potty. And so you kind of fit it in with your life and, you know, whatever you're able to do without it feeling overwhelming. And that might look like just offering in the morning when you wake up and everyone's in bed and you just, you know, take baby to the potty. It might look like doing it the other way, you know, and in the evenings after work, again, when you're a baby, and just offering the potty at those times and not doing it during the day. It might look like doing it at the weekend. It might look like just incorporating into the nappy changing routine. So you change a nappy, you hold baby over the potty, which is what people used to do in this country before as well, many years ago. So that's part-time EC. It's knowing that you can't offer the potty all the time, but at the same time, changing the mindset from the nappy is a toilet to the nappy is a backup. And there is a potty or a different place where they can eliminate.
Right, yeah. Now, you mentioned how, you know, you live in London, which is a cold climate. So how can you do EC if you don't live in a warm climate? Like there's so much having to take off all these layers just to try.
Yeah. I mean, EC when you're out and about is definitely harder. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always happen, right? And that's why the baby wears a nappy and you say to them, hey, you're wearing a nappy, and they know and they can go in the nappy and it's fine. For example, when you're at home, obviously homes are kept warm anyway. So I always had my babies in like t-shirts, or I took the onesies and just tied them around their waist so that they didn't have the legs. It's, you know, it's definitely fashion for at home rather than out and about. Or I would even cut the baby grows and just cut the bottom bit and just use them as t-shirts. And then they would have a nappy on or no nappy on, depending if they were crawling and what stage they were at. And sometimes we use leg warmers. So it just kind of looks like adapting your wardrobe, basically. Mm-hmm. And you know, being okay with the fact that you probably can't do it when you're out and about, but you can do it when you're at home. And that's, it's still quite consistent and babies know.
Yeah. And I know when I've talked about this in the past, one of my strategies has just been, we've usually lived somewhere where I can take my kids straight outside because they often prefer to go outside rather than on the potty. But how do you do this if you live in a city without quick access to the outdoors?
So it's a bit of a adapting. Personally, we use the sink quite a lot.
Yes.
Both of my babies were exclusively breastfed. So as you know, baby poo at that stage is kind of just like runny and not very abrasive. So we used to sink a lot, especially with my daughter. With my son, we did have it's called a top hat potty, which you might be familiar with.
Yes, I have one too.
Yeah. So it's just using the top hat potty wherever we are in the house. And he quite liked that actually, because we're still holding it in the classic EC hold, which is behind hold the thighs behind the knees. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't really touching the potty, you know, his bottom is just like hovering over it. He really liked that. And we used it until he was like 13 months. So it was a long period of just using that until he was happy to transition to a normal potty. And whenever we could, we also use the outdoors, but that's only a few months a year.
Yeah. That was good to know, actually, that he used it till he was 13 months, because I'm using it with my youngest at the moment, but I've never used the top hat potty before, and she's 5 months old. I'm like, oh, is this starting to get too small?
But... yeah, no, I know it feels small, but actually, as long as you can hold them, and, you know, a lot of times I was sitting down with the potty between my legs, so as long as you can hold them over it, it tends to work really well. Yeah.
Cool. Good to know. So, yeah, how do you... You've kind of already talked about this, but I'm asking how you can do this if you're away from home, you know, whether that's running errands or at somebody else's house or traveling somewhere else overnight. Do you have some kind of tips that might help?
I think it depends what you're comfortable with. I always think EC shouldn't feel overwhelming, right? And it's all about the communication side of things, rather than how many catches or whether they did do a poo in their nappy or a wee in their nappy. And sometimes actually being out and about, I found I was more in tune with my baby because I could pick up on what was going on for her because I was just focusing on her anyway, on them when we were going out. And so I just made a point of trying to catch the poos when I was out and about. And if there was a wee as well, then great. But I made a point of catching the poos because I could really tell when they needed to poo when we were out and about. And so I did go to a lot of public toilets and just held my baby over the toilet. And it worked fine. And the same when we're traveling, you just kind of adapt. And I also know that if it feels overwhelming and you didn't want to do it, it's fine. And you just communicate that and you say, you know, we're going out, you've got a nappy. And actually part-time EC can even look like just mentioning to babies that they are eliminating. So if you know that they're straining or they're about to do a poo, you can just mention you're about to do a poo or you're doing a poo. And that just keeps that awareness, you know, kind of awaken them. They don't lose that as they tend to do if we just use nappies and don't introduce a potty at any point. So it's whatever really suits parents in order to keep that awareness. And it can look like many different things. And I think that's what I love about EC, that it can be really flexible. And it's just that little change in mindset from like babies can't use a potty until they're 2 or 3 years old to you can introduce it from birth and then use it as often or as sporadically as suits your lifestyle.
Yes, yeah. I wonder if you could, because you mentioned how you could tell when your daughter needed to do a poo. Can you give me some examples of signs?
Yeah. it was quite obvious, especially at the beginning, lots of grunting.
Yeah.
She never went red in the face, but I know some babies who do like are really red in the face. There was some straining. Farting was definitely another one that was quite consistent with her. And she was a baby that pooed a lot. I know some breastfed babies can go a few days without pooing, but she did, I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I say 8 poos a day.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, for a very long period of time, which is another reason why I love DC so much, because then it was like, you know, maybe catching 5 poos in the potty already is like amazing. So, yeah, those were the main, I think those were her main signs for poo. And then eventually we introduced baby sign language. And so she was signing quite confidently by 13 months, just doing the potty sign.
And what I've noticed as well that my youngest is reminding me of is that their signs change a lot as well as they age. Like even now, my daughter's 5 months, her signs now for when she needs to wee or poo different than they were just 2 months ago.
Yes.
And I know they'll change again in a couple of months. So it's nice that with being so responsive, it's almost like I'm not even aware that it's changed until I'm like, oh yeah, this is what I'm paying attention to now, and she no longer does that.
Yeah.
And what I've noticed as well when I'm out and about with the top hat potty, just because it's so small, if we're in a car, it wouldn't work so well if you're in a city and you're just taking public transport. But in a car, you can just throw it in the boot and you can just, I'm able to just sit in the driver's seat at the moment and just put her on it if we're in a car park somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, now that you mentioned that, we had a really small potty, which wasn't a top hat, but a similar size that we also took in the car with us. And when they're a little bit older, We could put it in between. So we push the passenger seat all the way to the front. Obviously, you have to stop for this. You're not driving. but you push the passenger seat to the front. And then in that little space in between the passenger seat and the rear seat, you can put the potty there. And we had lots of potty stops like that. And that's how we could, you know, drive for a couple of hours without worrying about it. And we also found a portable toilet seat reducer, which is amazing because my daughter really didn't like just sitting on a normal toilet when she was little, which I don't understand, right? Because it feels like you're going to fall in. So we found, we found this portable toilet seat reducer, which I just took everywhere. And once she was sitting confidently, I could just use any toilet and also avoid touching the seat and just put it on any toilet and she could go that way.
That's so good. I see, because I was going through your website the other day and I think you've got that listed on there as one of the products that you have tried and tested and recommend.
Yeah.
Now, in your email to me, you said that lots of parents also have questions about how you transition from EC to using the toilet full time. So can you address this?
Yeah, I mean, this will depend, obviously, if you're using nappies or not. If you're not using nappies, the transition, it just happens naturally, right? One day they start telling you when they need the toilet and that's the easy, you know, gradually done. But when you use a nappy, whether you've done it full time or very sporadically part time, I do think the easiest way to do it is to kind of, I'll tell you first what worked for us and then I'll say kind of generally what I think about it. I think there's, for us, what worked really well when we were catching all the poos, and this happened, so with my son, it was 7 months the last time he did a poo in his nappy, and with my daughter, it was 10 months. So I waited until, you know, we were catching all the poos. We were catching some of the wees, less with my son, more with my daughter, and they were both walking. And then at that stage, I felt, okay, so they've gone through the, like, huge developmental stage that is mastering walking. And my daughter was consistently signing for the toilet at that stage. So I thought it's kind of pointless to keep her in nappies at this point. So I just explained to her, we're not going to use any nappies anymore. And she was 16 months. And I said, if you need the potty, you can sign. We're going to use pants. And that was that. And I put her in pants and she did not have a single accident from like the second day ever again. And now I thought that most babies would be like that. Now I see that was also her personality. With my son, the process was very similar. He took a longer to walk. So he wasn't walking until 16 months. I was quite impatiently waiting for that point where he was walking. And he wasn't very consistent in signing, even though he was, his language was way more developed, but he wasn't signing or saying we consistently. But I still sort of got the feeling that he knew when he was weeing, because he would pause, you know, he would stop what he was doing. Sometimes he would look at me to like say, hey, I'm weeing, you know, like, will you do something? So the same, I just said, actually, for him, we went on holiday and it wasn't my plan to stop using nappies, but we had limited space and we took the disposable nappies, which I don't love, and I didn't want to buy a second bag when we're out there. And so I thought, I think this is a good time. And it was a hot weather, you know, hot climate where we went to. And it just felt like the right time to helping along the, you know, the process. And so I said the same, like, we've only got this, you know, we've got three nappies left and we're going to use it for nighttime. So we're going to use pants from tomorrow. And can you please let me know when you need the potty? And he was more inconsistent and we had more accidents. And by that point, you know, when you have your second child, you're more relaxed. And we were in a hot climate, like I said. So if he did do a wee on the floor, we just, you know, washed it off and carried on with our day. And it was absolutely fine. And it took him a little bit longer to consistently say that he needed a wee, but he got there eventually. And that was that with both of them.
Fantastic.
Now, saying that, I know that my story doesn't apply to every parent.
Yeah.
However, I do think sometimes with EC, there is the risk, because it's very child-led, that we just keep, you know, kind of preempting and predicting what they need and when they need it. So predicting when they need the toilet. And that, in a way, can stop them from actually communicating that themselves. Some children will be signing very clearly, and I think if you know my recommendation is, if they're signing, if you're catching the poos and some of the wees, then you can probably transition out of nappies, because they're signing, right? That's a, that is a sign that they're recognizing what's happening in their bodies and they're communicating that with you.
Yes, yeah.
But some children won't sign at all. They won't say at all that they need a wee. And we keep preempting that need because we've learned those signals and their timings ourselves. And so, you know, it comes to like 2 or 2.5 and some parents are still doing EC, so they're still wearing a nappy and still preempting when their child needs to wee, and taking them to the potty before they actually communicate it. So I think here, in this case, my recommendation is to just give pants a go. Because I think children also really benefit from that autonomy that not having nappies gives them, because they are really in charge of their bodies at that point. You know, they're like, okay, I recognize this signal and this is what I need to do about it. And generally sometime before the age of 2, if you've done EC, works really well for that, because it's the age when they really want to do everything themselves. So you kind of tap into that desire for choice and autonomy by giving them more control over their bodies, if you know what I mean.
Yes. And like you said, that sort of age just before 2, around then, that's, I guess, when they're learning how to be able to pull their pants up and down themselves. Right. So it's quite an exciting sort of thing for them to achieve. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I was just wondering how, if you have other people in your life who have been practicing it with your children, if that makes sense. Like, do you have relatives or friends who are able to recognize your child's cues, or is this all on you at the moment?
Well, whenever my children would stay with my parents, I would just tell them based on timings. So I would say when they wake up from a nap, just put them on the potty. And if depending on their age, you know, it might be before the nap if they weren't, you know, kind of wearing nappies anymore, just before the nap and after the nap. So it would just go based on timings. Or like if you're going to change a nappy, hold them with the potty before you put any nappy on. I don't think my mum ever recognized those signals. And she's kind of the closest one. I think, you know, so our nanny who's with them now was also going on timings, I think. Yeah. So, and I think because she also looks after another child at the same time. So for her, it was easier to just go like, okay, before a nap, after a nap, at, you know, at certain intervals during the day, she would offer the potty and the toilet. And that's how we incorporated it. And I was comfortable with that, knowing, you know, that I'm not putting pressure on someone else to learn their cues and their signs. But they're also knowing that my baby would be offered the potty a few times throughout the day.
Wonderful. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's nice to know that that you had people in your life who are offering a potty to a baby. I know it's like, I love that we're kind of hopefully normalizing elimination communication, because I've now noticed that, you know, just having one or two friends who also recognize the signals because they've done it with their own children. If they're holding my baby, they'll just go and be like, oh, she might need to do a wee. Oh, yeah, she did. And I was like, okay. Oh, this is wonderful.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's like having that village of other caregivers who also, you know, are responsive. Now, something you pointed out to me that I found very interesting is focusing on the link between eliminating and feelings. Can you talk about this?
Sure. Yeah, this is a really interesting one. I've found this mostly, you know, through obviously my children, but I've also noticed that from speaking to other aware parenting instructors who've practiced EC, and generally then, you know, from working with parents later on. But I think it changes as babies change, just like with you were saying with the signals. But for example, what I noticed is that when my slightly older babies, I'm talking like 9, 10 months, would have a big cry, like a huge release of feelings and emotions, they would also then release their bladder and do a wee. And I noticed that all the way until the age of maybe 2.5, probably. I'm trying to think, maybe up to 3. I noticed my daughter that happening sometimes. It was the only time that she'd had an accident is when she was having like this huge tantrum and everything was coming out. I mean, like everything, all the emotions, all the feelings. And it's almost like she would release her bladder as that part of letting go of tension in her body. And I've noticed that happening with my son as well. He's slightly younger, he's only 2, but that's happened a few times when, you know, he's had a really big cry and kind of, you know, releases everything and lets go of everything. So that's one thing I've noticed, and I've shared with another instructor who's found the same. But something that is more evident is when children are slightly older, so more into the toddler years, and they tend to withhold mostly poo. That is often related with them holding on to feelings and tension. It's almost like a way of like keeping everything in control. But it's not just about control. It's more about, you know, there's this tension inside their bodies, and that also looks like holding it in. And there is a kind of like a relationship between children who seem to, you know, sort of, yeah, just hold all their feelings in rather than express their feelings, and to withhold as well. There can also be fear. So there's, you know, if there's this fear around using the potty or the toilet, that's when they tend to withhold. But that's the fear is a feeling. I find that the withholding of poo is very much related to holding on to feelings. And when I support parents with, you know, withholding, I often support them in playing more and help supporting them with, you know, crying and expressing their feelings more, because that kind of, it's indirectly helps with the whole withholding process. And the other link that I've noticed is that actually when children who are, you know, using the potty consistently, so this is not easy, this is when they're regularly out of nappies and consistently using the toilet by themselves, when they start having lots of wee accidents, the common assumption is that children are too busy playing and that's why they didn't use the potty. And I'm sure that might happen sometimes, but what I think it's more related to, and I see it with my son, is again when they're holding on to, they've got like accumulated feelings, it's like they can't really listen to what their body is saying. It's like they pick up on that signal and either, you know, they ignore it because they've got so much going on, or they're not actually responding to that signal. It can be, you know, when you're kind of a small child and this is a new thing that you've recently learned to use the toilet, I'm guessing that the signal that your body gives you of like, I need to wee, is, you know, might be subtle. And if you've got other things going on and you've got, you know, tension and powerlessness and other things accumulated in your body, you might either ignore it or not pick up on it because you've got other things going on. What that would look like is, for example, yesterday, we were home and I noticed that my son woke up from his nap and he was slightly, you know, a little bit agitated. And he was playing and then suddenly he looked at me and said, "Mummy, wee," but he was already weeing. So I took him to the potty, you know, got him changed and all of that. And I just kind of made a mental note of like, oh, I think there's something going on. And 5 minutes later, he had a huge tantrum. Over nothing, over, you know, completely one of those, we call them in a way parenting broken cookie moments, when, you know, so it's called the broken cookie phenomenon because the story is that a mom hands a biscuit or a cookie to a child and the biscuit is a whole biscuit, but it's broken in half and a young child has a huge tantrum over this, right? So it's a broken cookie moment because we understand that they're not crying because the cookie is broken in half, but because there's all these other, you know, it's like the stroke that broke the camel's back. So yeah, that's what happened with him. He doesn't have accidents very often, but I could tell that there was, and he was playing, and I can see why parents might interpret that as like he was too busy playing and that's why he didn't stop. But I think there's another layer to that. I see that as actually he had other things going on. I could see the agitation. I picked up on it when he woke up. And that's what prevented him from actually just going, either saying, "I need a wee," or going to the toilet.
Interesting. See, I haven't noticed so much the link between the feelings, but I have noticed like what you were talking about with playing before. It reminds me of both of my older children. It had been weeks or months since I'd previously had an accident, but if they were playing hide and seek, and it was always hide and seek, and if they were the ones hiding, but I guess that I don't know if it was like that anticipation or excitement of hiding that, but yeah, it was almost guaranteed that they would have done a wee when they were hiding.
I kind of don't feel like it was because they were hiding. It's that, like you said, that excitement, that anticipation.
And another link I've noticed, and especially it's like current as in today with my youngest, is if they're going through like a developmental leap, or if they're sick, usually it's the first sign of sickness. If I'm like, oh, she did a wee when I was not expecting her to do a wee. Mm. And then I find out like a day or two later, oh, she's got a cold. I see. This is why that is.
Yeah.
Now, is there anything additional you'd like to say about elimination communication that I've forgotten?
No, I think we covered it all. Yeah, like you said, I do hope it becomes more mainstream and the parents see. I think there is this view that, you know, it's all or nothing with EC. Like, it's either no nappies and you just hold the baby all the time when they need to go, or you just wear nappies full time. And I would love for EC to be somewhere in the middle, you know, of like, yes, we've got different lifestyles now and you can use nappies and you can use any nappies. That's your lifestyle. We, you know, we use cloth, but if you want to use disposables, whatever it is. But it's just changing that mindset to knowing that there is a toilet. There is a place that children can go that doesn't have to be their nappy. And whether you offer it, you know, at every opportunity or you just offer it a few times a day or even a few times a week.
Mm. I think, I think this has been a good segue for us to talk about along the lines of the feelings and that sort of thing. It's a good segue for us to talk about what happens when this parenting continuum of meeting their needs is broken from a trauma perspective. And a point that I've really tried to make with this podcast is that some of our culture's practices are inherently traumatic for babies. Can you address this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the I was thinking about this. I think one of the main sort of potential causes of trauma is our culture's insistence on separation. Whether that looks like separation at birth. I know there's quite a few places that still separate mums and babies when they're born, if you're in hospital, and it's common practice. Whether it's separation, you know, later on a few months down the line when babies are, parents are told to keep babies in separate rooms, whether it's separation when parents are told to send their babies 5 days a week to, you know, a kind of nursery setting. And I wanted this to sound, you know, as in this is a cultural thing, a systemic thing, rather than individual parents making choices, because I understand a lot of the times parents can make no other choice because of the circumstances that we've created for ourselves. But these are causes of trauma in babies and young children that we are not very aware of necessarily. So I think the separation, I think powerlessness is another one. So the way we treat babies and young children is very disempowering, and the powerlessness accumulates and can also be another source of trauma. And the other one is disconnecting from feelings. So that looks like telling children not to cry, or distracting them from their feelings. And I think these practices are just so common in our culture in so many ways. And again, it can lead to very similar symptoms as you know, what is accepted as complex and major trauma.
Yeah. Can you tell us about the effect that this, well, I guess, accumulation can have in childhood and later on?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it depends on the kind of trauma. And obviously, I want to separate, you know, complex, what is known as complex trauma and adverse childhood experiences, or sometimes it's referred to as capital T trauma, because the effects of the symptoms of this trauma are very well understood and they're easy to see in children. And right. It's when we think of a traumatized child, you know, this is what people think of, you know, capital T major trauma. And obviously, as parents, it's our role to try and prevent this kind of trauma, right? And certainly not perpetuate it. But then there's the other kind of, it's sometimes it's called mini trauma or little T trauma. And these are, yeah, the things like separation, like might come from separation. There's birth trauma. There's all that, you know, kind of the little frightening experiences that might happen to children that start to accumulate, just like complex trauma. It starts to have an effect on the body, on their behavior, and long term this might look like chronic illness. And there is now an understanding in the scientific community that trauma is at the root of many for example autoimmune diseases and chronic illnesses. However, there is not so much an understanding. I think trauma is a continuum as well, you know, just like many things. We used to understand trauma as like there's just complex trauma, and this we now know the complex trauma causes, you know, manifests itself as these things later on in life. But trauma is actually a continuum. So on one side, we have the complex trauma that we're talking about, and on the other, we have all the little like mini traumas. And those things start to accumulate in the body as well. If you could, you know, I think a good analogy is if you have two jars, and in one jar you place three rocks, and each big rock represents complex trauma, you know, physical abuse, mental abuse, sexual abuse, all of these things. Mm-hmm. And on the other one you place little pebbles. And obviously you'd have to put in hundreds of pebbles to fill the jar, but they will fill the jar equally as much as the three big rocks fill the other jar.
Right.
And you can see, yeah, the effect long-term can be very similar. And at the beginning, you know, when children are very young, they obviously they don't have the layers of experience, trauma, memories and past that we have as adults. So it doesn't look as, you know, it's not as evident maybe, or it might look like actually if they're very hyperactive, for example. So this whole idea that toddlers are moving nonstop, especially boys, that they move nonstop and that they, you know, just jumping all over the place all the time. It could actually be a sign of, you know, accumulated feelings and accumulated stress and eventually accumulated trauma. But equally dissociative behavior. So a child who's constantly sucking their thumb, we don't recognize this so much because we think, well, they're really, you know, they're really placid. They're really easy to, you know, to look after because they just suck their thumb and sit in a corner. But actually that is a dissociative behavior that again might be a way that they're coping with the stress and feelings of everyday life and these separations and these things that our culture insists on.
Mm-hmm. Now, how can parents help their babies and children to avoid this trauma altogether? Is it even possible to avoid it altogether?
Yeah, no, it's not possible.
No.
And in a way, it's not our, you know, we can't prevent them. We can't prevent them from ever experiencing trauma, ever experiencing hurt. I think it is worth mentioning that trauma is not the event, but how we make sense of it later. And the way children make sense of events is with their caregivers, through all their caregivers. And I don't mean to say that you need to talk to them about it and explain it because, again, children work differently. They don't work at a rational level. But I'll give the example of, for example, parental divorce. So it's not the divorce that is traumatic. It's how the child experiences that and how he how he makes sense of it. So if the parents don't talk about it, if they try and maybe not engage with the feelings. So for example, and I can see why parents would do this because obviously this is difficult for parents as well. But if they said, well, don't worry, it's going to be wonderful. You're going to be spending, you know, three nights here and three nights there. You're going to love it. And just dismiss the child's feelings instead of listening to their feelings. That might, you know, lead to trauma a lot more than if the parents are open with their child and say, this is what's going to happen. I know it's difficult. And they know how to support them through play and through crying, through those feelings that will inevitably emerge from this traumatic experience. And then it might not, you know, have the same impact in their lives because they've worked through it. So we can't, you know, we can't prevent all types of trauma all kinds of trauma from happening to our children. But this is what I love about aware parenting is that it understands that when trauma does happen, we can help children heal from it and we can help them process the emotions that are attached to trauma so that it doesn't have that effect in their body and their brains. Obviously, as like I said before, as parents, it is our job to stop children from suffering complex trauma, right? So physical, emotional, sexual abuse. And I mean, Gabor Maté says that all trauma is intergenerational. I would say not all of it, but the majority of it is. Because we know that when children are abused, they become adults who are abusers themselves. So that's what, you know, that's kind of what he's talking about. And in a lesser degree, when children are shouted at, we become shouty parents. And I've seen that myself. And it's a difficult cycle to break. But that's where, you know, our work comes in to really undo those intergenerational patterns so that our children don't suffer from that kind of trauma. And then when they do experience it, because again, it could be, you know, a climate event that brings, you know, a traumatic event, then we can help them heal from it because we're aware of the symptoms of trauma and we're aware of how we can help them heal from it.
Right. Now, so say, for example, there's, I don't know, a parent or a grandparent, teacher, relative, somebody in the child's life who is quite a constant figure, but they're continuing a parenting practice that is, say, for example, they're not sitting with them while they feel their feelings, or they're continuing to perpetuate this, not seeing it as an issue. So how can parents help their children when this is like an ongoing sort of scenario?
I think there's two ways. One is to try and, we can try and reduce as much stress as possible, right? Mm-hmm. Like we said, so our culture has these practices that, you know, are inherently traumatic. So if we know that separation is really difficult for a child and we can avoid it to a certain degree, we will try and avoid it. And, you know, sometimes we can't and we need to send our children to nursery and school and whatever. And so we can, you know, be aware of that. When it comes to, you know, grandparents and other figures that are close to children who might be engaging in these practices, we can, try and take children out of their situation. But it's not always practical. And we don't always want children to not spend time with their grandparents, you know. So there's obviously, there is the side of like just talking to them and explaining to them. And sometimes grandparents are not willing to listen, or they're not open to that, or it's too painful because obviously they did things differently. And they can't now, you know, kind of see that it might have not been the ideal way. And in those situations, I think it's an individual decision of whether, you know, what will benefit your child most to have this contact with their grandparents or not at all. And again, to know that if you feel comfortable with your child spending time with their grandparents because that is important to you, that you, as long as that child has an environment at home with their main caregivers where they can't express their feelings and cry and rage and heal through play, then that they will be okay. That it's okay, you know, for other caregivers to not be as attuned to these styles of parenting. At the end of the day, it's like as long as the main caregivers are able to provide that space, it's almost like children know, and they know that, well, maybe, you know, grandpa is a bit shouty and he doesn't play too much, and then grandma is, you know, threatens me and punishes me, or the opposite, or gives me sweets every time I do something right or whatever. And it's like, well, you know, as they grow up, they kind of figure it out, but they know that at home they've got that space. And they've got that, you know, openness and willingness to listen to their feelings.
Yeah. And I think it just occurred to me then to bring this up that I know a lot of people comment on how, say, a child has spent the day, whether that's at school or at a grandparent's house, but then they come home, which is their safe place, and they have that chance to let out all the emotions that they weren't able to do during the day. That sort of you know what I mean, don't you? Now, can we talk about how you've touched on this already about behaviors that we think of as normal, like bouncing off the walls. I wonder if you could just elaborate on some of these sort of behaviors that we consider normal but they're actually a consequence of, you know, accumulated stress or unmet needs.
I think, well, especially with toddlers, that kind of non-stop, you know, being really busy, loving, being really rough, the idea that toddlers are really rough with each other or with pets and animals, there is a big, I wonder whether to mention this or not, I'm going to say it. There's this big understanding that parents are told that there's like a sensory seeking disorder, maybe, you know, that the toddler is constantly looking to like spin and spin and spin and spin, or like swing and swing and swing and swing. I see that more as again, you know, it's just accumulated stress, and the swinging or the sensory input is providing for a slight dissociation from whatever is going on. So there's that. I think the movement is one of the biggest ones, but there are other behaviors that either children engage on from their own, you know, because they find these behaviors help them cope with the feelings, or we as parents unknowingly help them with these behaviors. So one of them would be, for example, using a dummy, or sucking their fingers if they don't have a dummy, like sucking their thumb constantly. There's a lot of, you know, I've seen toddlers kind of twirling their hair, nose picking. And I didn't, obviously all toddlers pick their nose, but I mean like constant, you know, constant nose picking, or nail biting as they get a little bit older. So all of these behaviors help them suppress the feelings and dissociate from whatever is going on at that moment. Or, you know, not think about that unmet need. But yeah, toddler, you know, toddlers not being able to sit down at the table, not being, running away is a really big one actually. So when you're walking, and I know in a city it's slightly different, but it's still, it's, you know, obviously you do have to keep your children a little bit closer. But when children don't have this accumulation of stress and feelings, they don't run away. They have this sense of danger and they want to stay close to their caregivers, at least within eyesight. And I've seen so many parents then engage in even more disempowering behaviors because the toddler ran away and now they're, you know, they're using a leash, for example. So it just perpetuates that cycle of powerlessness. And I say this with compassion because I know, like, parents, we have such a hard job and I don't want anyone to feel judged, but I do wish parents would be more aware of these things and the root cause of it, because then we could, you know, address it in a more compassionate way, I guess, with ourselves and with our children. But yeah, so many of the things that we consider normal in toddlers, and also, well, with, to do with sleep, you know, the whole, either children should just sleep through the night in a different room for 12 hours straight, or the opposite, that it's normal for children to wake up every 45 minutes because it's, and I'm talking, you know, not about a 2-month-old, but like a 12-month-old,
right?
Waking up every 45 minutes or every hour, and that being normal as well. So kind of both sides of the spectrum. And I know from experience and from becoming a parenting instructor that there is somewhere in the middle. Children can have the need for connection met. And that means that it doesn't mean that necessarily will sleep for 12 hours straight, but it means that they won't be waking up every hour looking for something.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. That was my next question to ask you about sleeping. And I'm so glad you touched on that. Now, but yeah, before I go to the next question, which is about childism and oppression, is there anything more you wanted to say about trauma?
I think it's such a big topic. I mean, I could talk about it for another hour. And I think as a culture where, you know, it's, they say that it takes 12 years for something that is known as scientific community to trickle down to the rest of the, you know, people. And I wonder where we are in this, because I do would love for parents to be more aware of trauma and how it's inherent to our culture, because it's only through that that we can change these practices and support parents so we don't have to engage in these practices.
Yeah. And I think one of the other challenges is trying to get your village on board with them, because these sort of practices, the benefits, they take such a long time to actually, yeah, to see the benefits in your child as they grow older.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're not getting these instant results. It's a long-term sort of thing. So
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so before we wrap things up, I am curious to hear your thoughts on childism and oppression.
I think it goes hand in hand with this kind of disconnection that we have with ourselves. And it's interesting that we're living in a time where we're trying to be more inclusive of all types of people and all types of differences. And at the same time, we're not addressing the root cause of where these differences, this unacceptance of differences comes from. Because just like we were saying, you know, if a child is shouted at, they're more likely to grow up into adults who shout at their children. Equally, if a child is, you know, treated in this kind of very hierarchical, disempowering way, they are more likely to grow up into adults who continue with these practices. So if we're trying to build a more inclusive world, we should start with children. because they hold the key, you know, to having a less oppressive society and more inclusive society, one that is more connected to their feelings and themselves. And because when we're connected to our feelings, we're connected to nature, we're connected to each other, we're less likely to harm each other. So yeah, I think, I mean, childism, and I see childism everywhere. And it's quite sad. Again, just like these, sometimes I feel like I have the opposite of rose-tinted glasses. You know, when I walk out and I see, you know, children who most people would see content and happy in a pram with a dummy, I see they're completely disconnected, right, from themselves, from their parents. And it makes me sad. And the same with other, you know, childish practices that happen in nurseries and in schools where children have no agency. They have no control over their own bodies, but also in families, you know, when they're punished or they're sent to out or they're told what to wear, what to eat, where to eat. So yeah, I think, and again, I'm not criticizing individual parents, but a whole society that's made us believe that children are not capable of choosing for themselves and being their own individuals, right? And actually, it's the other way around. If we could trust our children more, if we could really see that they're the perfect ones and we're the imperfect ones, in a sense, because we've got all these years and layers of baggage, whereas they came into the world from, you know, like a place of perfect goodness. And then we could, it would make our jobs as parents easier as well, because then we could trust that they, you know, that they will, we just need to model and they will naturally want to follow us.
Yeah. 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 I couldn't agree more. Now, I think I can hear my baby calling for me, so I'm going to need to wrap this up. So now I will put links in the show notes to your website, Parenting Together, and your Instagram page. Where else can I send people who want to learn more about what we've talked about today?
There's the Aware Parenting Institute, the main website, if you're called to learn about Aware Parenting, and the Aware Parenting podcast is a great resource by two Aware Parenting instructors. It's really big in Australia, Aware Parenting, but hopefully that will translate to the rest of the world.
Great. Well, Maru, thank you so much for reaching out and suggesting these topics to cover. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. It's been an honour.
Yeah. Well, thank you just so much for taking the time to share your knowledge with us.
Thanks, Emily.
So, yeah, my final question for you to end on is, what do you think is the greatest challenge facing our world today, and what can we do to address it?
I'm going to go with the disconnection of feelings. I think when we are more connected to ourselves, then we can connect with each other, nature, the world. And the same with our children. If we allow our children to stay connected to their feelings and their emotions, and we can trust the children to know exactly what they need, then we'll raise children who live in a very different world.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.